This is the Waters and Harvey Show. I'm Darren Waters.
And I'm Marcus Harvey.
One of the most talked about films in 2017 was the movie Hidden Figures. It's a true story about the critical contributions African-American women made to America's space program during the height of the space race with the Soviet Union in the 1960s. Today, we will talk with Dr. Christine Darden, who was a member of that remarkable team of women who helped our nation emerge as a leader in space exploration. You won't want to miss this conversation, so join us. We'll be back in a moment. Again, this is the Waters and Harvey Show. I'm Darren Waters. And as usual, we're so happy that you all are joining us in the audience. So glad to be here in the studio with my brother and my co-host, Dr. Marcus Harvey. Marcus, it's nice to not be flying alone.
Nice to be here too, brother. How are you?
It is. I'm doing pretty well. Yeah. Looking forward to this conversation.
So
I think it is a great honor to have Dr. Christine Darden here with
us.
One of those remarkable women. You and I, you know, you love movies. We've talked about movies a lot. Hidden Figures. Brother, did you have a chance to see this film?
I did.
Really good.
It's a remarkable film. I think that highlights a lesser-known aspect of the country's history and a lesser-known contribution made by just a remarkable group of African-American scientists and mathematicians.
It gives us a real chance to see some of the challenges that we've had in our country with the issues of race and the issues of gender. I mean, challenges that still are with us today, I would think it is fair to say. But this movie, I think, gives us a glimpse of what that really looked like.
And I think also what the film highlights is that really the American scientific establishment really, especially during the 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond, throughout the Cold War, was one of the major epicenters of sort of white supremacy and white patriarchy in this country.
Right.
So for these women to be able to navigate those spaces and make such a contribution is just phenomenal.
Right, and to keep, you know, themselves together going through the pressures. You and I have talked about this, and thinking about our nation's founding, the ideals that founded our nation, I couldn't help but think about the Enlightenment. You know, and the ideals that emerge out of the Enlightenment, which are really the driving force behind the founding and colonization of America in many ways. I mean, there are other issues that are involved. Well, we get into those complexities. Don't have time to do that here. But it's interesting to think, Marcus, that, you know, from the time of the Enlightenment, you know, if we want to go back to the period of Columbus's, you know, discovery of the New World, so to speak, and say, well, the Enlightenment ideas go back even further than that. But to think that even in 2017, from this period of time, that we still could talk about having challenges with issues of race and gender, despite the issues and the ideals that emerged from the Enlightenment.
Yeah, and I think what's so ironic to me about the film and about trailblazers like Dr. Darden is that, you know, Enlightenment thinking, you know, was vehemently committed to the idea that precisely the type of thinking displayed in the film and practiced by Dr. Darden shouldn't exist in people of color, especially in African-American women.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, the example of Dr. Darden and the example of Dorothy Vaughan, Mary Jackson, and Katherine Goebel Johnson really kind of give the lie to a major component of Enlightenment ideology vis-a-vis race and gender.
They do. I thought, Marcus, says I was thinking about Dr. Darden and her generation and the members of that team at NASA. I couldn't help but think about Sojourner Truth, who I think, what is it, 1851, when she gives this speech in, I don't know where she gave the speech, but it was entitled Ain't I a Woman, talking about the rights of women, not just African-American women, but women in general. And it's an important speech. If you've never had a chance to read that speech, I mean, it's a remarkable speech to read. Also, she gave a speech later on where she made a real strong advocate. She was a strong advocate. This is 1867, after the Civil War is over, where she is calling not only for, at this time, she's talking about suffrage rights for women in the United States. And I think think about the fact that here we have an African-American woman who was born into slavery and is fighting for the same issues that we see emerge in this movie, Hidden Figures.
Yeah, yeah. And she able to do this in a way that involved reason, right? Reason being one of the skills that going back even before the Enlightenment, that especially in Victorian Europe and earlier, a skill that women were believed to be incapable of, right? These are creatures of emotion, not reason. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, figures like Truth and others give the lie to that thought as well.
They do. So we have Dr. Christine Darden here in the studio with us today, and we're going to have a conversation with her. And Marcus and I would like for you all to stay here with us, and we'll be back in a moment for that conversation. Again, this is the Waters and Harvey Show here at BPR in Asheville, North Carolina. Marcus and I, again, having a wonderful conversation, looking at the contributions of African-American women, especially to the space program. We are delighted and absolutely honored to have as our guest today Dr. Christine Darden, who was a member of that team of women that you see displayed, are talked about, portrayed in the movie Hidden Figures. She is someone who is not unfamiliar with Asheville, North Carolina. She'll talk to us a little bit about that. She's a North Carolina native as well. I've had many good conversations with her on the phone, and I know that you all are going to be delighted to hear this conversation with Dr. Darden. Dr. Darden, Marcus, and I want to take the moment to just welcome you here back to Asheville and to the studio. Thank you.
Yes, so welcome. Thank you
so much.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. We've had a number of conversations. Dr. Darden says she's going to try to keep me away from history. As a mathematician, you know, her field is a field that I find frightening. I am impressed with anyone who can jump into understanding numbers. It was not my forte.
Mine either.
Yeah. But it is wonderful to have you here in the studio. So welcome back to Asheville. I mean, we just want to begin, you know, simply with the question, you're no stranger to Asheville, as we just talked about. Can you tell us a little bit about your relationship to Asheville, North Carolina?
Well, in 1956, my parents sent me to Allen High School in Asheville, North Carolina. And though I resisted at first, I think it ended up being one of the best things that might have ever happened to me in my life.
Wow. So can you tell us where you were from originally here in North Carolina?
My home is Monroe, North Carolina, just by Charlotte, North Carolina, yes.
So it had to be strange coming up here to these mountains. Had you been here before coming to Allen? And what year are we talking about here?
I came in 56.
1956.
Yes. I had been through here, I believe, but not here to visit. Yes.
All right. I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the particulars of your time at Allen High School, because those are some interesting conversations that you and I have had. So we'll come back to that.
And more. I'm curious to hear, Dr. Darden, what prompted your parents to insist on sending you to Allen High School, especially in the late 1950s?
Well, I'm the youngest of five children, but I was alone with my parents from 8 years on, because all of my older sisters and brothers had gone away to college, were graduating from college, and everything like that. And my mother taught out in the county. My father was an insurance salesman, and he typically didn't go to work until 3 o'clock in the afternoon to catch people at home to collect premiums and things like that. My school was right across the street, which meant I could get home quite a bit of time before either one of them got home. And they did not like me being at home alone. So that was part of the reason, I think. The other part of the reason was I was 2 years younger than all of my classmates. And so there were some tensions on my wanting to go to dances and do things with some of the other students in my class that my parents felt I was not old enough to do. And so there were some tensions there. And I think it was primarily those two things that thought maybe that if I could go someplace where everybody had the same rules and things that, right. it would be better for all of us.
So it seems to me it's really clear that Alan had a strong reputation. Then had you heard of Alan before, prior to them beginning to talk about sending you?
No, I had not heard of it, and I'm not quite sure how my mother heard of it.
It's interesting. At Alan High School, it emerged as the African-American women's high school here, although I have recently discovered from conversations with other students who went to Alan High School that at one point there were some males who went to school there as well, which I didn't know about. This was, I think, during a period of integration when a number of African-American men went to school at Alan. But I know the school has its roots back in the late 19th century, because I write about it under another name in my own dissertation. I know it was founded originally as, I think, a Methodist school by the Pease's, who were who had retired to Asheville, Ann Pease and L.W. Pease, who had retired to Asheville from New York. Do you know any of that
backstory? I don't know that history, but it was still a Methodist school when I was there.
That's right. And then it became, you know, it was originally.
It was Alan Home at first.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Now, Dr. Darden, you have expertise in two disciplines that, as Dr. Waters alluded to earlier, for me have been quite intimidating, mathematics and science. Could you speak a little bit about what attracted you initially to both of these fields?
I originally thought that I liked biological science. I will say that I had two older brothers who had both gone into medicine and everything, and so I was leaning in that direction. But I loved to help my dad with working on the car, changing tires, making my brakes on my bicycle out of coat hangers, things like that. So I began to realize that I really liked the physical sciences better than I did the mathematical, the biological sciences. And so by the time I left going to college, I had pretty much decided that I wanted to go into the mathematics and the physical sciences rather than biological sciences. And I did okay in the classes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, this is so interesting because I used to have in high school, I thought that I wanted to be a microbiologist. but I landed in college and took a real course for biology majors and discovered that, maybe you're best housed in another discipline. So I ended up studying literature, but I too shared an early interest in science.
So. See, I can assure you that I never had an interest. I made it through these, in which I marvel at with my own children, especially my younger son, Lewis, who has a big interest in science. I don't know where that comes from. You know, it did not come from me. I think it may have come from his grandfather, Edgar Waters, who is someone who was really, really good with numbers and math as well, because he had been a computer technician in the earlier part of his career. But I think that maybe my own son has picked it up, it went down a generation or two. It kind of skipped me. But I am always impressed with people who go into those particular fields. So this is wonderful. I would like to ask you one question about Alan and thinking about Alan, because it has such a rich history here. I mean, it has a very active alumni as well who are really engaged with that high school, which no longer exists now, but it has such a rich history. Did your time at Alan, how did it impact your worldview? Is that a fan? Did it help to facilitate and stimulate your further interest in the sciences?
I believe it did, science and math. I think two things happened at Allen to influence that. My senior year, my job was to get the newspaper and put in the library. And on October the 5th, 1957, I picked up the newspaper that had the headline that the Soviets have launched Sputnik, and it has orbited the Earth over four times over the last 24 hours. So that made a big impression on us. And I had never really been away from home before, and so I grew in that direction, that I was broadened, and I was not homesick when I went to college.
Oh, okay. Well, so it helped kind of get you ready for that. All right.
So, yeah, and this is interesting. So Dr. Arden, what I hear you saying is that even as a high schooler, there was an awareness of the political sort of struggle between the United States and the Soviet Union vis-a-vis the space race. Oh, so high schoolers.
I went through hiding under my desk earlier than that. We went through drills in school because we were afraid a bomb was going to be dropped on us.
The Cold War was an interesting time. I mean, it
to
really was.
To say the least.
Yes. And it's interesting to think about that generation that was coming through that and how they think about it. I mean, this is where history becomes important, I think, because we have a tendency, because we're beyond this period now, to not think about, you know, the mindset that particular period of time really created. So this is interesting.
Interesting. So, Dr. Darden, could you talk a little bit about how you ended up at NASA? I mean, this is one of the preeminent institutions in the country.
But I'm going to tell you, Marcus, I'm going to insert myself in before you go there. Yeah. Because, see, I'm sitting here in the studio with two people who went to historically black colleges and universities. And so you, Morehouse, and I know Dr. Darden went to Hampton. And thinking about even the tradition of historically black colleges and universities, I really wanted to hear about your experiences at Hampton as well, because you went on to Hampton University. How was it at Hampton?
Well, Hampton was great. I wanted to go in a direction where none of my sisters and brothers had been. So I had this independent streak. I did not want to follow them into college. And I had a friend whose sister went to Hampton. I knew nothing about Hampton. And I went in that direction. And I went there wanting to major in mathematics because of Allen and my geometry teacher at Allen, who I fell in love with the class there. I didn't have much math because geometry was the highest level of mathematics I had in high school. But nevertheless, I said I wanted to major in math. But my father says, this is 1958. There aren't that many jobs for an African-American female in 1958. So I want you to get a teacher certificate so you can get a job when you graduate.
Right.
And obeying my father, I says, well, I've got to do this. But I had also thought of being this mathematician. And that's when I made a decision that I would take all the education and math required for my teacher certificate, but I would use all of my electives to take the higher math classes that weren't required for me. And so my senior year, I took 8 higher level classes that were not required for me to graduate. And that was sort of this push that I still had this mathematician in my mind.
Right.
Wow. So going back to the NASA question, Dr. Darden, could you talk a bit about the path that led from Hampton Institute at this point? So it was Hampton Institute to NASA, working on major high-speed projects, et cetera.
Okay, well, that was sort of the beginning of that path.
Okay.
So I graduated, and I taught for 2 years, and I continued to take extra math classes at Virginia State at this time.
Okay.
And when I graduated from Virginia State, I went by the placement office and I asking the lady if she knew of any jobs that were available. She says, where have you been? NASA was here recruiting yesterday. And I said, oh, I knew nothing about that. She says, will you fill out this application and bring it back to me and I'll send it in. So she did, and I had an offer in about 3 weeks. And so I was hired at NASA because I guess I skipped the part where taking the extra classes had led to my getting a fellowship, a research assistantship at Virginia State College under the physics head of the physics department. And so those 2 years I spent there working on this research assistantship in aerosol physics, I got a master's degree in applied mathematics. And so all of those things together, I think, made my credentials look more attractive to NASA, and I was hired by NASA in 1967. That would have been 2 years before we walked on the moon.
Right. Now, your parents, were your parents still living when you went to work at NASA?
Yes, they were.
And how did they respond? What was your father's response to this opportunity opening up?
I think he was very happy for me. He wasn't. I don't think he had anything against the mathematics. Mm-hmm. I think his was this assurance of getting a job. Mm-hmm. Yes, and since I had a job, he thought that was great. And a year or so later, I had a child after when I was at NASA, and I was thinking about quitting, kind of worried about going back to work and having to find somebody to take care of the child. My mother said to me, "That's a very good job you have there, and I think you need to hold on to it."
Now, how long did you stay at NASA?
40 years.
40 years. 40 years. That's a long time. Now, I'm thinking about, you know, so many were coming out of the 1940s, 1950s, and there are not a lot of opportunities. Many pathways for African Americans are kind of limited at the time. So I could understand exactly where your father was coming from and talking about the opportunities that existed in mm-hmm. education, you know, at the secondary level, high school level, on into higher education. But thinking about the opportunities would exist at places like NASA, I'm sure.
He didn't know about that.
Yeah.
He didn't know about the hidden figures in NASA.
Now, this makes me wonder about, again, the importance of the civil rights movement. I mean, the civil rights movement is occurring at this time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're at the height of the movement, you know, the 1960s. So it seems like it's having a major impact on opening up new avenues of opportunity for African Americans.
I believe it did, but it was A. Philip Randolph, I think, who went to President Roosevelt and asked him to issue an executive order that any defense industry mm-hmm. could not be discriminatory in who was hired for jobs. Right. And that's when the first black females were brought into NASA. They brought the white females in 1935 and the blacks in 1943.
Right.
Oh, and wow. So the ladies in the movie all were hired into that segregated group, 43, 53, 51. And so I was quite a bit behind them, and I was not in a segregated pool like they were
right.
because it was now NASA, because when Sputnik went up, NACA, which is what it had been called before, became NASA, NASA, and it did not have segregated pools in there.
Okay.
So that was a slightly difference in the experiences we had. And I went into a reentry physics branch, which calculates the angles and the speed and the temperatures of vehicles coming back into the atmosphere to see if they can handle it, see that they won't bounce back into space. But that had already been calculated for the Apollo program by the time I got there.
Oh, wow. Wow. This is all so interesting. And I'm watching time move very, very quickly here. So I want to ask you a question, and Marcus as well. You have talked about your work at NASA and working on developing a higher order sonic boom predictor. Very complicated term. When I heard you talk about this, I was thinking, I can't begin to even wrap my mind around what this is. But you've explained it in ways that I think that I understand. Can you tell us a little bit about what this was about?
Okay. Supersonic flight has been prohibited in the United States because of the sonic boom. That was done in the early 70s, just about the time I went into an engineering program at NASA. And people still wanted to go fast. They still want to, you know, get places faster and everything. But with this law and everything, NASA said we need to see if we can reduce that sonic boom. And so one of my first projects was to see if we can design the airplane that would make the sonic boom of a supersonic airplane softer.
Okay.
And so I worked on that for many, many years and, you know, did wind tunnel tests, did flight tests and everything. And one of the things I've been so excited about is that NASA is supposed to be building a supersonic low boom X-plane in 2018.
Wow.
Pretty excited about that they will build this plane and test it and hopefully change that rule about supersonic flight.
Well, and Marcus, I want to turn it over to you here, but this is making me want to ask questions about, like, the Concorde, you know, as an aircraft, I mean, which went away, but I was always so interested in the Concorde. And and everything surrounding just the engineering with the Concorde.
Yeah. And it went away. They only built 14 of them. Nobody bought any of them because they didn't have anywhere to fly except right. over the water.
Right.
When I called them once to ask for how much the ticket was between New York and Paris or something, it was like $6,000.
Oh,
and this
grief.
Was back in the 70s.
Yeah, this is fascinating. Can I ask one quick follow-up question? What was the concern about the sonic boom, like the loudness of it? Was it because was there concern about it causing ear problems with those who
well
would
it
hear
was
it, or?
Breaking glasses, breaking sheetrock in houses and things
okay.
like that, and annoyance would if you were in a job okay. where the startle or the annoyance could be a factor, mm-hmm. it would have been that also.
Okay.
So one thing that we have to touch on before wow. we leave this conversation is the movie Hidden Figures. What did you think of the movie? And your name emerges in the book quite a bit. I was looking at the book and looking at the index, and you're mentioned in the book quite often. What did you think of the movie?
The movie was great. I watched the movie the first time just as a movie without knowing the ladies or anything, and I thought it was a great movie.
Right.
And I really enjoyed it, and I've only seen it 11 times.
Okay. So we're encouraging those of you who have not seen Hidden Figures, you have to see this movie. It is truly, truly a remarkable story.
And it's really interesting to hear, Dr. Darden, that your experience with NASA was not segregated, whereas the experience of the woman in the film pretty much was.
That is true.
Yeah.
That is true.
Right. And it is amazing to think about this history, you know, mm-hmm. and the history that we do need to confront, but to see how, you know, so much talent has the potential to be wasted because of issues that we've had with race and gender. And I hope that we're getting to a place in the country where we're dealing with that a little bit better. Well, we've just got a couple of minutes left here, but Dr. Darden, before we do go out of this, I want you, if you can, quickly tell us about, as you've talked to me about this, of having a career formula. And I think that our audience...
Yes, I think that formula pushed me to take all of those classes. And I started out with P4P, that if you know a job that you really think you're going to want to do, perceive of yourself in that job. Perceive of yourself as a mathematician or as a literature professor. But then plan what you have to do to get to a job like that. And I knew that I would, especially with not a lot of math in high school,
right.
that I would have to take a lot of mathematics because I would have to build my mathematics background and right. my physics background. And the third is prepare. Work your plan. Mm-hmm. The fourth is persist because you'll run into detours and problems and everything. And I'm thinking now that I ought to add a P5 because I think at the beginning of that, maybe you ought to make sure that the job you think you want is a job that's not going to be displaced by technology
right.
these days or something mm-hmm. like that, that it would be a job maybe you would make enough money you could live on.
Right.
And I think our young people today need to think about that.
Well, a great message, a great conversation. We applaud you for a remarkable career, and thank you for joining us. And Marcus and I will be right back in just a moment. Again, you've been listening to Waters and Harvey Show with Dr. Christine Darden. This has been a great conversation, Marcus. We have I've really learned a lot.
I have too. And I mean, just to think about the wide-ranging contributions that our people have made to this country is just really, really inspiring.
Okay. So again, Marcus, you always close out these conversations very well. We thank you all for joining us. And Marcus and I want to remind you all again that the Waters and Harvey Show is produced at Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville, North Carolina.
And you can listen to our podcast on BPR.org, on the BPR mobile app, and on iTunes and Google Play.
Follow us and get in touch on Facebook and Twitter. And Marcus and I will look forward to talking with you all again next time. Thank you.
Take care.